Full Story is supported by Telstra. Big ambitions need the right partner, and that's where Telstra comes in. Telstra works with enterprise and government organisations across Australia to help them build, connect, and grow at scale. They support real outcomes, from secure business growth to connecting schools to networks that help keep communities safe. Telstra is a long-term partner for organisations with complex needs and big plans. Together builds better, wherever they go. For enterprise-sized solutions, partner with Telstra.
This is The Guardian. I'm Joe Tovey, and this is the Full Story Newsroom Edition. This week, we're talking about the rise of One Nation and its first electoral test since their polls started soaring over the summer. With us once again is Mike Tischer.
Hey, Joe.
And dialing in from Adelaide, we have Senior Investigations Correspondent Sarah Martin, who's been breaking story after story about Pauline Hanson. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Joe.
Over the past summer, it's been tempting to write off One Nation's polling surge as a passing fad fed by the bin fire in the coalition party room. But it's not passing. The surge is real. An Ipsos poll earlier this week found one in four people would vote for One Nation if an election were held today. That poll was conducted after Pauline Hanson's latest racist remarks, effectively downplaying that there were good Muslims in February and a wafer-thin policy agenda. Her party's newfound popularity will be tested at Saturday's South Australian election and the May by-election in Farrah. But I think it's fair to say One Nation is already reshaping Australian politics. And today I want to discuss why and the media's role in all of this. So, Mike, I want to start with you. Do you think it's fair to say that One Nation is effectively the de facto opposition in Australia?
Well, in some senses, not at all. Obviously, they don't have any seats around the country. But I do think they are setting the agenda to a large extent, and every party is having to think about how to respond to that. And so to that extent, it's kind of in a fluid situation, I guess, where they're exerting a level of influence that they haven't done for a very long time, if ever. But on the other hand, they're kind of not represented at anywhere near that level in actual results. So yes and no. Sorry to give a very yes and no answer.
Sarah, what do you think?
Look, I think they are forming to be a de facto opposition, but they're not an opposition to the government in the sort of traditional sense that we think of as an opposition. They're sort of an opposition to both the major parties. They've sort of become this opposition voice within the right side of politics as well. So they're sort of, you know, in many ways, they're the opposition within the opposition, because they are really going into those fractures within the coalition and forcing the coalition to sort of have this fight amongst itself about where it stands. So, like, I think it's really been really fascinating as we've seen that sort of breakdown in the traditional sort of left-right divide, how they're kind of changing that debate. And they are sort of, they are feeding on that voter cynicism to say that we are the only people who are fighting all of the rest of them, all of those career politicians in Canberra. And so they are driving the conversation in a way that perhaps traditionally a good, effective opposition might have been. And they're certainly changing the political debate in a particular way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're seeing that across state and federal governments. I thought it was interesting this week, Chris Minns did a bunch of interviews a year out from the election, and he talked about migration as an issue in New South Wales and the mix of migration, which is kind of not something we're used to hearing from him. Obviously, Angus Taylor, when he became leader, put Australian values, so-called Australian values, at the forefront of his agenda. So we are seeing the issues that One Nation wants to foreground being picked up by the other parties already and reshaping debates. I want to talk a bit about why this is happening. What do we know about who is moving into One Nation's column, and why are they doing it?
I think there's a bit of the jigsaw missing here that no one has really quite found the key to yet, if you can find a key to a jigsaw.
Sure, let's go with it.
Their numbers had risen dramatically over the summer, which is true, but they'd also started rising before that, since the election. They only polled 6-point-something% at the election. But after that, pretty much immediately, their numbers started going up and continued to go up gradually, and then kind of accelerated perhaps after Bondi, that may well have had something to do with it, but I don't think that's a major factor. There was something going on in that period that I don't think anyone's quite identified, because all the factors around cost of living, housing, economy generally, people's sense of grievance, unhappiness with both the major parties, all those factors were there before the election as well. They weren't reflected in the federal election result to anything like the same extent. And then they kind of broke the dam somehow.
Do you think part of that is the coalition's collapse, like the terrible result at the last election and then just the absolute chaos of the period since, that a lot of people who were on the right of politics naturally would have just thought, these guys are a mess, I've got to look elsewhere?
I think obviously that definitely helped. And once they got to a certain percentage of support, there's a certain sort of permission factor there, that where you feel like, well, if 20% of the population think they're okay, then, you know, there's no kind of taboo in saying I support them as well.
And also Barnaby Joyce, who was a sort of mainstream political figure a lot of people have known, you know, for decades, has moved into One Nation. That also provides a degree of social license, I think. Sarah, what do you think about their rise?
I mean, I think there's a few things going on. I think the sort of very sort of rapid, dramatic increase is largely the coalition's base shifting to One Nation. I think that's a huge part of it. But then I think there's this slow burn element as well, which is sort of, you know, has been decades in the making. And that is the same trends that we've been seeing in the UK and the US, where you have a lot of people, particularly in the regions, feeling very disenfranchised, feeling very ignored and very let down by the major parties, and this sort of economic compact that people felt that they could have a good life by working hard has been broken. And I think arguably, you know, we have had this neoliberal consensus from the major parties for a very long time, and that has let people down. And so in some ways, some of what One Nation is saying is not wrong, right? Like, there is some truth to the fact that the major parties have let people down, and people feel that they are living it. You know, cost of living is real and acute and hurting. Housing affordability is out of reach. They're not offering any solutions to those problems, but they're certainly very good at harnessing all those grievances and perhaps rightly attributing some of that blame to the neoliberal consensus of the major parties. Now, those two phenomena are really sort of driving this upswell in support for One Nation, and it's partly structural, it's partly cultural, and some of it, I think, sadly, is inexorable, because I think we are seeing the fruits of those policy failures really manifesting themselves in that support for One Nation. And as Mike, as you say, there is that sort of permissiveness now, and I think that's also contributing to this rise.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And we've seen that in the US as well, with this strange crossover between the MAGA base and Zoran Mamdani voters. I think what these two groups have in common, despite seemingly being at opposite ends of the ideological spectrum in some ways, is a sense that the system is broken. There is a sense they are looking for political outsiders to solve problems. They do not want the establishment, and they kind of want to burn the place down. I think it's interesting that the Greens have not increased their vote during this period. I think it speaks to perhaps a failure on the Greens' part to be that sort of left-wing economic populist voice. They've been pretty absent, apart from sort of foreign policy issues this year. You really haven't seen the Greens taking centre stage, and it'd be interesting to see if that changes between now and the election.
Yeah, I think there is a real opportunity for the Greens, and even, you know, potentially the Liberal Party, if they're prepared to actually acknowledge that some of their party's, you know, previous manifesto hasn't worked so well for working people, then potentially there is a way to come at this from the left as well. And I think that's why Andrew Hastie is quite an interesting character, because he is a bit more interventionist. He's not sort of the same, you know, Howard, Angus Taylor mold of politician. He has been prepared to talk about coming to some of these problems in a way that's not just let the market fix it. That traditional left-right divide is no longer quite as clear-cut as it used to be, and you do have that sort of weird confluence of the far left and the far right, perhaps sometimes offering similar solutions to these problems. So, yeah, it's a fascinating time to watch Australian politics.
And I think you could add to that also an opportunity for independents who can talk to people where they are, in the way that you described Mamdani doing. But as we've also seen, both in rural independents and inner city ones having a lot of success. And I do think that's sort of tapping into the same strands of views in some ways that they don't want either of the two major parties.
Yeah, I think David Pocock is a good example of that too.
You know, they're coming at it from a different point of view from One Nation, obviously, and from the Greens, but they are kind of offering something different that to some people is also attractive.
I guess just before we move on, I do want to say, though, I think it's hard to talk about One Nation's rise and appeal without talking about racism and immigration, because it's not just the economic message they're selling, and it's actually that tie-in between economic fears and then the scapegoating of migrants. I mean, I think something interesting that we've seen along with the slow rise of One Nation, as you pointed out, Mike, is in the Scanlon reports, at least, we've seen an edging up of Australians who say that they think immigration levels are too high. There's also been a rise in the number of Australians who have negative feelings about Muslims. And I think One Nation are fairly effectively weaponizing and tapping into that sentiment in Australia. And that's something I think the media is generally maybe a bit less comfortable talking about, but I think it's real.
Yeah, I mean, it's really worrying to see how the media is mainstreaming Pauline Hanson and downplaying her racism. That is incredibly concerning. And we know that the right's propaganda is to demonise migrants and to blame them for all your problems. So, oh, you're unhappy? Well, how are we going to fix this? Oh, well, let's just stop migration, because that is a culturally lazy, you know, appeal to worst instincts of people. It is not the answer, clearly, but it's far easier to send that cultural message than to actually look at the structural problems that are behind those grievances, right? And like, I think it's super fascinating when you look at the people who are switching to One Nation. They are the people who are least likely to be living alongside migrants. They're the least likely to be in, you know, urban housing markets where some of those pressures are particularly acute. And that is because this is like a cultural issue. It's a demonizing the other. It is like a classic trope that has been a part of, you know, right-wing propaganda for a very long time, and it has to be called out.
It's interesting how Malinauskas has tried to address this, I think, by talking about migrants in economic terms and how much value they bring to the South Australian economy. I don't know if that'll work, and I certainly don't think politicians denigrating Hanson as a racist, making that the focal point of their criticism of One Nation, I don't think that's a successful strategy, regardless of whether or not one might think it's true or a fair point to make. The classic, clearest example of how not to do this was in the 2016 US presidential election, when Hillary Clinton referred to Trump voters, she thought of them as the basket of deplorables. That famous quote that has just been repeated, and rightly, frankly, as a really terrible example of blaming the voters for what are actually the policies or the attitudes of the party you're opposing, and that did not work out well for her. But I agree, obviously, we shouldn't lose sight of the things that she says and how people respond to them.
I mean, I agree that attacking Pauline Hanson as a racist is not going to change many minds, but you can't ignore it either. You can't pretend it's not part of her platform. And at the same time, you know, I think you can't sort of completely dismiss people's concerns that there are pressures on in the cities particularly, and that is partly as a result of migration. Like, I don't think you can pretend that problem doesn't exist, but, you know, that is not the migrant's fault, and addressing those concerns is not, you know, let's stop migration or let's limit it to X, Y, Z. It's about finding the, you know, the public spending, the welfare, the infrastructure requirements that are needed to ensure that we can manage a growing population. And of course, we need migrants to come into this country. They are staffing our hospitals. They are staffing our nursing homes, our aged care homes, our childcare centres. They are doing a lot of skilled labour, a lot of unskilled labour in our economy that, frankly, we cannot do without, particularly with an ageing population. So, yes, like, it's absolutely part of the discussion, but it's really concerning that people seem so prepared to just sort of underplay or forgive the racist elements of her platform.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's such a fine line for politicians to walk there. Like, I do understand the argument that you will alienate increasingly large proportions of the Australian electorate who've already said they'll vote for One Nation if you label her a racist. At the same time, racism is a moral evil. It hurts communities, and to see politicians not call it out when it happens, I think damages the fabric of Australian society in a really detrimental way, and potentially allows her to sort of keep going and for others to speak the way she does. So I acknowledge that that's difficult.
But also, wasn't it interesting that the person who most strongly called Hanson out over the no good Muslim comments was Matt Canavan? I mean, that sort of blindsided a lot of people, but he sort of did something that I feel the other, like the major parties, were all a bit too nervous to talk about in such strong terms. I thought that was really fascinating.
I want to talk a bit more about the media's role in covering Hanson. And Sarah, I want to talk about what you've been doing. You've been sticking with a very particular type of coverage as an investigations reporter, which is looking at issues of transparency, of donations, and also Hanson's special relationship with Gina Rinehart. Can you talk a bit about why you're pursuing those stories and what you've found?
Well, I mean, I think firstly, if we are looking at the rise of One Nation, I think it's really important that we understand who is behind this push financially and why they want this party to succeed. And we know, and sadly for me, I spent way too much of my life looking into Gina Rinehart, so I know how much she wants to have this nativist style party in Australia. She is friends with Nigel Farage. She is a Trumpet. She has been desperate to get this sort of political movement up and running and successful in Australia. She previously supported Peter Dutton, but now she is all in behind Pauline Hanson. And I think it's really important that we are clear-eyed about the sort of Australia that Gina Rinehart has advocated for. And she is clearly financially supporting One Nation. Pauline Hanson likes to paint herself as an outsider, as someone who's challenging the status quo. She likes to suggest she, unlike the other politicians, has integrity and transparency, and you know, she's honest, and people are sick of those lying politicians in Canberra. She is something different. Well, if she's going to be out there telling people that she stands for transparency and accountability and truth and honesty, unlike all those other lying, scheming politicians, then, you know, it's absolutely incumbent on us to hold her to account. And if she is the battler, but she's the battler who's flying around on Gina Rinehart's $70 million luxury jet. So I think it's extra important that we hold her to the level of accountability that she claims she is bringing to politics in Australia.
I think another important piece of political coverage is to be talking to some of the people who are targeted by One Nation's rhetoric, and to be covering racism as an issue in Australian society more generally. We did some stories a couple of weeks ago on the threats that mosques have been receiving in increasing and alarming numbers. I think it's important to be showing the full spectrum of humanity in Australia and Australian life, and not just reducing migrants to kind of talking points, or even from the left as sort of economic useful units to sort of portray people as people, and to show the effects of what a kind of increasingly racist discourse in political life does to people in our communities. I want to return to some of the ways Hanson's reshaping politics, which I think was evident in the choice of Matt Canavan to lead the Nationals last week. Despite cutting his teeth at the Productivity Commission and KPMG, Canavan presents as a high-vis wearing outsider to politics. He's pro-coal, he's anti-woke, he's a religious conservative from Queensland, and he's now out there presenting his vision of a hyper-Australia. What do you think Canavan's elevation tells us about how the coalition plans to fight One Nation, and how effective do you think he can be?
So Matt Canavan wrote a super interesting, what I thought was a very interesting piece in The Australian this week, setting out his kind of vision, which was partly a bit ludicrous, like everyone's birthright is a backyard big enough to play cricket in. That obviously is a big ask.
It's a great time for satirists,
yeah,
again, I've got to
exactly.
say.
And all this stuff about, you know, we don't need foreign ideas, we don't need to import resources, we don't need to import people. All that stuff sort of had echoes of, he was quoting C.S. Lewis, it was a sort of had echoes of John Howard and the White Picket Fence, or John Major and British politics going backwards, quoting George Orwell about how great things were in the old days. But he is talking about the same ideas as Hansen in a lot of ways, but I think he's trying to put a more positive spin on it. And in that article, he did not denigrate migrants. My point is he's trying to project some of the similar ideas, but in a different, in a markedly different way from her, I think, in that he's trying to present it in a much more optimistic and less kind of the whole world's going to hell in a handbasket way. I think that's really effective, but you said, does it say anything about the coalition strategy? I think it says a lot about the potential National Party strategy, but I don't think that's necessarily great for the coalition because, as we've seen before, inner city voters can very easily be turned off when the coalition are tied to previously Barnaby Joyce and now potentially Matt Canavan in their utter rejection of environmental policies. So yes, I think interesting take on the migration issue, potentially great for the Nationals, maybe not so great for the Liberals and therefore the coalition.
I mean, I think this is absolutely about self-preservation for the Nationals, right? Like they are under existential threat from One Nation. You know, Matt Canavan is trying to save the Nationals by basically being as similar to One Nation as he can be. Now, that's fine for the Nationals. That is really problematic for the coalition because the coalition can't be more One Nation than One Nation because, well, they can, but they'll never form government if they do that. And then the other thing is if people are going to be like, well, do I choose One Nation or do I choose the people who are pretending to be One Nation? Well, I'm just going to go for the real deal because, you know, they're just copying One Nation, right? So I don't think you can really overstate how much strife they are in at the moment. Like this is a realignment for the conservative side of politics and we're not quite sure where it's going to land, which is why Matt Canavan is trying his darndest to save his party and his own seat by being a bit One Nation-esque as much as he can without further causing implosions within the coalition.
There's a real possibility they kind of win a battle here to save the Nationals but lose the war in the process,
totally.
Right? Yeah. I just want to talk about the wild card that's been thrown into this diabolical political situation, which is, of course, the war in Iran and the absolute economic chaos that has unleashed on the world. In the last week alone, we've seen petrol prices surging. We've had an interest rate rise and potentially more to come. On Wednesday, Jim Chalmers warned that we could see inflation getting into the high fours or even potentially over 5%. Do these sort of diabolical economic conditions, do you think, potentially juice One Nation more? What's going to be the effect of all of this?
Yeah, they do. I mean, we mentioned this last week that the very areas where those will hit hardest in rural areas and regional areas and people who have to drive long distances from the outer suburbs are the people who are going to be hit first and hardest by fuel shortages, fuel price rises, and all the other price rises that are caused by the oil shortage. So, yes, it feels like it can only supercharge all those feelings of grievance about cost of living that are already fueling the rise of One Nation. So presents the government with an absolutely, as you say, diabolical problem to solve as if the economy wasn't difficult enough already.
And I think the other problem with that and what's happening and what is in the pipeline is how and when does that start to nibble at Labor's vote in outer metropolitan seats? If people are facing successive interest rate hikes, can't afford to fill up the petrol tank, if those promises that the Albanese government made, you know, two terms ago, things are going to be better under a Labor government, brighter future, etc., if that all starts to feel very hollow and life is continuing to be economically painful, then I think that's when it's really going to bite for the government, because then a lot of those people who are feeling unhappy with the Labor Party but who aren't particularly impressed with Liberals or Nationals and don't see them offering any solutions, well then where are those people going to go? They're pissed off. They are absolutely ripe for the One Nation picking, and I think that's what the government, I mean, I think they are alert to this, but I think that is, you know, really scary times ahead. You can bet your bottom dollar that Pauline Hanson is going to be in those areas trying to harvest those grievances and bring them on board the One Nation train.
And there's a risk here too, isn't it, that like we've seen some signs, as we talked about last week, that this is a budget where Labor seemed focused on intergenerational inequality and some of the big structural reforms that governments have dodged for years in this country, tackling the kind of the structure of the housing market, CGT, negative gearing, etc. If they back away from that in this environment because things are so volatile, it potentially, it extends these problems, it kicks the can down the road, and I think it potentially fuels these populist movements for years to come because, you know, the housing crisis, if you listen to One Nation voters talking at polling booths, that seems to be like the issue. My kids can't buy a house. Politics has failed. If politics fails here to act on that, where are we going to be 5 or 10 years from now?